Welcome to Journalism History, a podcast that rips out the pages of your history books to re-examine the stories you thought you knew and the ones you were never told. I'm your host, Terry Finneman, guiding you through our own drafts of history. This episode is sponsored by the University of Tulsa, TU, a private research university that features small classes taught by accessible professors with 90-plus majors in three colleges. Ranked number 86 among colleges and universities by U.S. News, TU is home to 17 NCAA teams. TU students do undergraduate research, regularly win prestigious national scholarships, and upon graduation, land some of the highest-paid jobs in the region. Forward-thinking, the University of Tulsa emphasizes global education, community service, and lifelong learning. School mascots, pipeline protests, addiction, welfare. These are common themes today for how and when Native Americans are covered by the mainstream press. In today's episode, our guest John Coward of the University of Tulsa delves into problematic and stereotypical press portrayals of Native Americans in both historical and current times. He is the author of Indians Illustrated and The Newspaper Indian, Native American Identity in the Press, 1820-90. John, welcome to the show. Today we're going to talk about two topics, how Native Americans are portrayed in the media, and then also how they have used the power of their own presses to make their voices heard. First, though, how did you become interested in studying Native American journalism?
This was really a topic that I did as a research project as a graduate student at Texas. I got interested in 19th century journalism in particular, and what fascinated me there was the technological shifts in 19th century journalism, the invention of the telegraph, the development of photography, organization of the Associated Press. So I had this interest in 19th century American journalism, and that's what got me into, you know, thinking about what happened, you know, what was being covered in the 19th century in journalism. And there was westward expansion, Manifest Destiny, the Gold Rush, those kinds of things. And that's what led me to Indians, because, you know, I was well aware of the Indian Wars, especially after the Civil War. So it was a topic that kind of grew out of my general interest in 19th century American journalism.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about why you wanted to write Indians Illustrated, which focuses on illustrations published between the mid-1850s and the 1890s.
I just was interested in the, starting out with the pictures. Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper were popular in the 19th century, and I just got fascinated with the images. They became more popular with the Civil War, and then after the war, with westward expansion, there were increasing numbers of pictures of Indians, and these were popular, and they were widespread. And you had things like the most famous Indian battle of them all is the Little Bighorn, and there are these quite fictional images of Custer's last stand, that kind of thing. This was an interesting topic to me, because the pictures are so well done, some of them, and they're also quite fictionalized, some of them. And so there was this these amazing pictures that, you know, some people had researched them, but there wasn't a full study of these kinds of pictures. And I thought, well, these are important, and they're understudied, and, I could do something with this. And, you know, what the other thing about it was photography existed, and some of the Indian portraits and other things that showed up in Harper's and Leslie's were based on photographs, but there was no halftone process. So there was no technology for Harper's, Leslie's, or any other daily paper to publish photographs. So that's where you get the illustrations. And, you know, one of the things that fascinated me about that was how the illustrations could be fictionalized. You know, a photograph could be staged, but an illustration based on a photograph or the imagination, you know, purely fictional, that could be even more, more fantasy. So that I thought, boy, there's a lot of room for a lot of wiggle room in here for, portraying reality or portraying fantasy. And Native people were certainly subject to that.
You talk about illustrations that reduce them to symbols or caricatures, actions that had major consequences on the lives of Indians in America. So talk more about some specific examples of what you found and what the consequences were of this.
Right. Yeah. What I discovered was certain kinds of visual tropes or stereotypes get repeated. So there is a range of Indian imagery in Harper's and Leslie's, but it's fairly narrow. I do a chapter in there on women, Native women, and a lot of Native women are portrayed either as kind of the Pocahontas Indian princess. That's one major way that Native women were thought of in the 19th century, and Harper's artist and Leslie's artist tended to repeat that. And so you get the Indian princess on one hand, and then on the other hand, you get the Indian squaw, and it's used, they use the word squaw, and the squaw imagery in those papers tends to be older women, sometimes women as beggars. So they're not, the princess is young and beautiful and motherly, a lot of admirable kind of romantic qualities. And then the squaw, on the other hand, is kind of the polar opposite, the sort of degraded, poor, impoverished, older Indian woman as beggar. So there are some exceptions. There are lots of ambiguities and contradictions in these images, but that's one example. Our Native women, reduced mostly to these two kind of competing stereotypes. And the same thing happens with Native men, who can be romanticized sometimes. As noble, the noble savage is the cliche, the stereotype. And so you get some of that Native men, with kind of muscles rippling and, on horseback, surveying surveying the plains. You get this plains Indian stereotype. And then on the other hand, you get the bloodthirsty warrior, the ignoble savage who is a bloodthirsty killer. It's again a kind of competing stereotypes. So that those that dominate, they're not the whole universe of Native images in these papers, but they're pretty popular, and especially in times of war, when after the Little Bighorn or any kind of violence in the West, this would get reported in New York and Harper's and Leslie's, and reduced to cliches. So you'd get a lot of that.
You criticize the media's continued inability or unwillingness to deal with race and culture in a fair, balanced, and nuanced manner. Why do you think that inability or unwillingness exists?
Yeah, that's a complex question. And, I've been, my professional life as a scholar has been looking at this. I have a term I use called the understanding gap that, in colonial United States and then later in the early national period and then after the Civil War, papers published by, English-speaking Americans, Anglo-Americans, they just brought a whole different set of assumptions about Native people to bear. And so there's just this kind of profound gap that, Native people had their own traditions, their own customs. It was very different. If you think about a nomadic tribe, like the Comanche or the Lakota in the plains, the gap between, somebody like Horace Greeley, who I actually wrote about, Greeley is an apostle of going west, go west young man attributed to him. And, Greeley, when he does go west in 1859, sees Native people on the plains and just is, by today's perspective, certainly he's pretty clueless. He doesn't have a way to make sense of these people. He thinks, he's the Protestant work ethic, kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of guy. And he thinks, these people are lazy. The men are lazy. The women do all the work, and they're primitives, and they don't have any religion worth speaking of. They don't have any social life, any political organization, no technology. Now, that's profoundly ethnocentric, but that's where we are in the 19th century with a lot of people, not just Greeley. So that You know, Native people did have certain kinds of, you know, technology. They were great with, you know, subsisting off the land. The Comanches and the Lakota and the Crows and people were wonderful horsemen, you know, and loved their horses and adapted to the horse, which was not native to the New World, you know, came in with the Spanish. So they had their skills and their abilities and their ways of life. And this was just so different. And, you know, newspaper people, printers, publishers, reporters later never quite grasp the enormity of this, you know, this kind of cultural clash. And I mean, you can't in a way expect them to, you know, cultural pluralism is something we could talk about today. You know, no, you know, Horace Greeley didn't think that way. Nobody in the 19th century really kind of could fully make this kind of leap that that you needed to make to see Native people from the Native point of view. You know, the 19th century war reporters are certainly not going to do that, you know, on the plains. And you're certainly not going to even people who were friends of the Indians, you know, Philadelphia and Boston and New York had church people, some women after the Civil War turned their attention, some well-to-do white women turned their attention from abolition to supporting the Indians. But even they were, you know, woefully unprepared for understanding, you know, these people that they wanted to help. So that, you know, it was a persistent problem, and, you know, in some ways it's still out there.
What do you think of coverage of Native Americans in the press today, and how much of the coverage they've had historically, the problematic coverage, are we still seeing printed today?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes, to some degree. I mean, we're not in the 19th century anymore, of course, but, you know, Native people are a small part of the U.S. population, less than 2%, I think is the most recent figure I've seen. So they're easy to ignore and overlook, and they frequently are ignored and overlooked, even in communities where, you know, where their Native people live. They frequently are not, they're not news sources, they're not covered. So there is a kind of marginalization that continues. And there's also, they're not taken seriously sometimes when they are covered. In other words, I know Mark Trahant, who's a longtime Native editor and stuff, has talked about, you know, getting a Native in a lot of communities, getting a Native perspective on, he says, like on a prayer in the schools issue that would be covered. You know, there's a Native perspective there that could be covered in a lot of communities. Oklahoma, you know, I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma City, we have large Native communities, and other places do too. And a lot of editors and reporters don't think about that, you know, in part because they're so invisible. So there is an invisibility problem, and that's, you know, that continues today. And it could be, and sometimes is addressed. And so there, you know, there are small steps forward, and that's a good thing.
So we talk about the invisibility. Native journalists I've talked to have certainly complained about parachute journalism and how Natives tend to only be covered when there are negative issues, like the battle over school mascots, the pipeline protests in North Dakota, addiction, criminality, welfare. What advice do you have for non-Native reporters about how to do a much better job covering these communities?
Right. I know. I think you're right. Native people, I do listen, try to listen myself to what Native people have to say, and listen to people. You know, there's an organization, the Native American Journalists Association, and I've done some things with them, and they have good guidance on this. And, you know, one of their ideas, and makes sense, of course, is just to learn some history about, you know, there are almost 600 federally recognized tribes. The tribes are not all the same, you know, in the 19th century. And the work I did on in Indians Illustrated and the newspaper Indian, Indians get reduced to sort of generic Indians. You know, an Indian is presented in Leslie's and Harper sometimes as an Indian with no tribal affiliation, a lot of times without a name. That's, you know, they're reduced that way. But with all this diversity, That's one thing that reporters today and editors, assignment editors, can do is is what tribe are we talking about? And then learning something about that tribe, its traditions. That's one way of you know, showing some respect and getting the story right. And you're right. I know Native people do complain about the sort of crisis. You know, we're only news when there's something bad happens. It's all crisis oriented. And so we can't get any good news stories or just ordinary stories about life on the reservation or in Oklahoma, where we don't really have reservations, but just Native perspectives, you know, on the news. Now that, you know, that is changing, as I say, I think slowly, but this, there is a need for mainstream journalists to go to Indian country and learn something first and listen to people, you know, sort of listen and learn. And that would go a long way, I think, toward alleviating some of the problems. You know, here's another way of thinking about it that somebody explained it to me one time, is Native people, from their perspective, you know, they see a reporter come in and it's not new to they see it, we're going to get the same old treatment, and it's part of a pattern. It, you know, it was true 100 years ago where we were reduced to stereotypes, 50 years ago stereotypes, you know, 20 years ago, and even today. And I think their perspective is, you know, we need to get beyond this. We need to talk about something besides, you know, ceremonies and alcoholism and poverty and you know, those have been and still are issues in Native communities, but there's more to it than that. There's a lot more going on, and some of those things are worth covering too. So there is a lot of work to be done, and I do think the Native American Journalists Association is an organization that's really tried to tackle that. And, you know, I recommend their, they have guidance on their website and they have publications. They even produced a little bingo card that they passed out, and each of the little bingo slots is for one of those cliches. And they say, if you bingo on this card, you know, you need to go back and rethink your story because you're hitting all the stereotypes.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I have a copy of that card myself, and we can include that as an extra with our transcript in case any of our listeners are interested in checking that out later as well. So let's switch gears a little bit and discuss the Native press itself and how it's provided a voice that the mainstream press hasn't. Briefly discuss the history of the Native press.
Right, yeah, that's been an interest of mine as well. You know, most of my scholarship's been on mainstream, you know, press covering, you know, how they cover and represent or misrepresent Native people and Native lives. But the Native press does have a long history and a really interesting history that's frequently overlooked. You know, the first Native paper was the Cherokee Phoenix, which dates back to 1828 in Georgia. Was, you know, founded to fight Indian removal. And, you know, they ended up losing that fight, but the press then was, you know, continued in Oklahoma once the Native tribes, the five civilized tribes were moved out in the 1830s. And a lot of them started papers then. So there is a long tradition of the Native press and, you know, giving Natives a voice, and, you know, obviously a good thing because they didn't have a voice frequently in the mainstream press. So there are tribal papers that were started. And then over the years, those Friends of the Indians started papers, missionaries started papers, Indian boarding schools had papers. So they're just dozens and dozens, hundreds of these papers that are, you know, some of them were minor and lasted only a few issues. Some of them were more, you know, were more militant and outspoken. Some were, you know, administrative kind of papers, like I mentioned, missionary and school papers. But there's this rich history of this Native journalism that, you know, there has been work done on it over the years. So it's not completely unknown to scholars and people who are interested. But it does a lot of times fly under the radar that there is this history at all. And like I say, some of these papers were minor and only lasted a few issues, but other papers had long and pretty interesting histories, which you know, that needs to be recovered. And, you know, I am trying to work on some of that, you know, since Indians Illustrated came out a couple of years ago, I've been working on this area to try to bring more attention to it.
So a couple questions related to that. First of all, how you're finding access to these papers. Are many or any of them digitized? Or are you having to go to individual archives? Where can we find these papers?
Yeah, more and more of them are being digitized. I have seen just recently there is a Native American digital project. I don't have that name, the exact name on the tip of my tongue, but I have seen work that they've done digitizing papers. One paper I had looked at was called, it's actually a magazine that was started called The Indian Voice in California. And it has been digitized now. So, but there are some things in various libraries digitized. And the other thing that's been helpful to me is the archive at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. They have a Sequoia National Press Native Center there. It's a whole library started by a couple of English professors there, Daniel Littlefield and James Perrins, who back in the 80s wrote a big three-volume guide to the Native press, you know, this big sort of Bible of the field, three volumes with documenting and all these papers. And they collected them, and now the university in Little Rock has them. So I've been able to travel there and look at original copies. Now, that you know, there are always gaps in the collections, but they have a really good collection. And in my case, it's not that far away. It's only a 4-hour drive. So I'm using their archive, and I'm going to try to go back. I go back in the summer and look at things there. So there are things online at various libraries, and the Little Rock Archive is terrific. And there are some other libraries that have collections of rare documents as well. But there's more online and coming online all the time, so that's actually a good thing.
So to go along with that, I know that in the North and South Dakota, there have been discussions in recent decades about losing language, right? And trying to preserve Native languages. So with these newspapers, are some of them written in languages that are dying out, so to speak? Do we have to worry about that?
I know the Native people are concerned. A lot of tribes are working hard to preserve the language and capture things on audio and video and teach the language to young people. And historically, you know, the Cherokee Phoenix I mentioned before was bilingual there. It was published in English and in Cherokee. And there were other papers that did that as well. But, today I don't know of any papers that are publishing in a Native language, although that may be the case. I know in Oklahoma, the Cherokees have some resources these days. They do have casinos here, and that's given them access to capital, and the capital has been used to build up their cultural resources, one of which is language preservation. So about an hour away from Tulsa here is Tahlequah, where there's the Cherokee capital in eastern Oklahoma, and they have an immersion, Cherokee immersion classes for young people there. So they are working really hard. I know other tribes, I know the Chippewa or Ojibwe up in Minnesota have language programs. And so I know several of the larger tribes that work really hard at keeping the language alive. And, you know, obviously a good thing. But in some cases, it's certainly an uphill battle. But the media, you know, with online and digital technology, there's more of that you can do. I know I went to a ceremony here several years ago, and they recognized a new language app for your iPhone and Android phones where you could for Cherokee language. And I think some of the tribes have done things like that so that it's there, you know, more access through technology. That's a good thing, obviously.
When you're working with some of these historical newspapers that are partly written in Cherokee, do you have an interpreter who helps you, or have you tried to learn some of the Native languages yourself?
No, I haven't gotten that far back. You know, the stuff that I've been working on has been 20th century more, so I haven't looked at that. Has occurred to me, obviously, if you look back at the beginnings of the Phoenix, when the Cherokee language, well, what does this say? And I've other scholars have done a lot of work on the Phoenix because it was the first paper, And so I've just looked at the secondary literature on that, and I have not gone back and looked at it, although I've been to some presentations where some of that has been translated, and so I've heard references to it, but I haven't gone that far. Although, what I would like to see is some younger scholars, Native folks, some Cherokee scholars and students, and Chickasaws and Seminoles, and all these tribes have younger people who do learn the language and can go back and translate and read what was published in the 19th century or later, so that it's, there are records of this and people who are aware of it. That would be a great thing. So I'm all in favor of that.
One of your interests is the rise of Red Power journalism in the 1960s and 70s. Tell our listeners what that's all about.
Right. Yeah. I started looking at the Native press, like I mentioned, the Cherokee Phoenix and other papers, and, some of them are interesting and have these amazing, lifespans, and interesting characters associated with them, activists and others. But what really caught my attention in the last couple of years, when I realized that in the 60s and 70s, there were activist Native writers and activists who said, let's, there's the women's movement, there's the civil rights movement. And in Indian country, there was the occupation of Alcatraz and Wounded Knee in the early 70s. And some of these activists started newspapers and magazines and newsletters. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And nobody has, there has been some scholarship, but there hasn't been a lot. And so I started looking at those, and I did a paper on one called The Warpath, started in Berkeley by a guy named Lee Brightman, who had some ties to Oklahoma. One of his parents was from Oklahoma. And he ended up as a grad student at Berkeley and, became more and more activist and started an organization called United Native Americans and published this newsletter called The Warpath for several years. And the United Native Americans, his organization, was sort of a competing with the American Indian movement and kind of lost out to them. It didn't thrive after a few years, but he, lived a long life and just died a couple of years ago. But in the newspaper, his newsletter was lasted 4 or 5 years, and was kind of the militant voice. I mean, it's called The Warpath, and he really attacked the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he was a big critic of the boarding schools, which were underfunded and poorly staffed, and there were lots of problems there. And he was pretty much a kind of rabble rouser and muckraker on that. He visited Indian schools and published it, findings of, here are the students at these Indian schools with the buildings are drafty and the teachers are ill prepared and they don't have Native teachers. The libraries are bad. The food is terrible. So he, Indian education was one thing he, went after as kind of a Native muckraker in the late 60s and early 70s. So, and there are more, he's not the only one. So I did get interested in that. I'm of that generation. I was an undergraduate in the late 60s and early 70s. So this sort of anti-war, I'm the anti-Vietnam War generation, even, I'm a veteran, so I wasn't particularly activist myself, but I can certainly relate to the social movements of the late 60s and early 70s. And so that Lee Brightman, The Warpath, and there was a Mohawk paper up on the Canadian border in upstate New York, Akwesasne Notes is the name of it, another militant paper, which kind of worked as a kind of Reader's Digest of activist news. What they did, the guy that ran it was a guy named Jerry Gamble, and they would clip stories from the New York Times and Ramparts magazine, if you remember that activist magazine, and other publications, and they would just reprint them. And they had some of the original content, but they did a lot of reprinting of stories from Indian country. And Akwesasne Notes caught on and had a circulation in the thousands and thousands. They said at one point in the early 70s, I think 100,000 readers is what they claimed. And you know, they were really producing thousands of copies and distributing them. So that was is fascinating to me, you know, this uprising of, I mean, what is it, Indian consciousness here of Native militancy. We want our rights. We want to be respected. We don't want to be marginalized anymore. Like the African Americans, we want to have a voice. We want a place in the body politic here. And so these papers, that's two. I mentioned the Indian Voice, this magazine in California. They did this. There were Alaska in the papers that also did some activism. So this kind of got my attention, and I've been working on reading these papers and trying to, you know, interpret them and understand what impact they had and how they did create a kind of activist Indian voice of in this period of time.
It's interesting to hear about the strong readership from several decades ago. What is the state of the Native press today?
Yeah, it's there's still tribal papers going, there are, you know, what's really happening, I think, is more online stuff. So that you know, we have individual Native folks who have the wherewithal to do their own blogs or their own websites, and some of the tribes have, of course, they have a print version of the newspaper, but they also have an online version. So you're getting more of you're getting more media that way. I know here locally the Cherokees have started a weekly television show called Osio. The word Osio means hello in Cherokee. And they, it's a really well done 30-minute broadcast, feature stories and news and tribal concerns. You know, it's putting the Cherokee voice out there, and it's produced by, you know, a Native crew. I met some of the folks that work on it, and they do interesting stuff. And so here they broadcast it here locally and around Oklahoma. So there are, you know, with the resources that some of the tribes have now, they've, they've got educated people who and people who want to get the tribal perspective out there. So, you know, they had all these decades and decades of not getting their voice out in the mainstream press. So let's do it ourselves, and let's do it in a more visible way. And so you do see that. And, I do see in other places. I know I'm familiar more with around eastern Oklahoma where I live, but I know in California there are tribes that are doing things, and in Minnesota and in other places as well. And that's, you know, that has, I think, revitalized some of the Native voice out there. There's just more technology. And it's some of it's fairly inexpensive. Setting up your own website can be done on the cheap, and so you've got people who can do that, and so they're doing it.
And the final question of the show: why does journalism history matter?
Well, you know, from my perspective, it matters because I've devoted my scholarly life to working on Native people in the press, Indigenous and Native voices. And so you can understand some of the problems of today by going back to the past. I mentioned that understanding gap that, you know, it's not the same as it was in the 19th century, but there's still some of that out there. And so you can, you know, the studying journalism in the past shows you, it's a window into the past. You can see what happened in, 1870. You know, one of the joys of the business, and I see this in my students too. If you have them read a newspaper article or a magazine article from the 19th century or the 20th century, it's all of a sudden vivid and immediate. You can, by doing that, capture a little piece of the sort of consciousness of the past. You know, what did people think in 1870? Well, we can't ask any of those people, but we can read their newspaper. We can read newspaper stories about events that happened and reactions to those events, and it captures something. So there's I think, you know, journalism history is about journalism in part, but it's also about all these other issues about, you know, race and, you know, in my case with Native people about, you know, ideas in the 19th century about progress and civilization and you know, the fight over resources, you know, land. So all this stuff, you know, some of that stuff still reverberates today that, you know, Native people still want to be recognized as, you know, they are Indian Native nations, and they have treaty rights and sovereignty. Sovereignty is one of these issues that Native people take real seriously, and most mainstream, you know, most ordinary journalists or ordinary citizens have no clue about this. And so, you know, studying the past obviously can enlighten you know, enlighten us about these, you know, where did these problems come from, and how did we deal with them in the past, and then how can we bring that to bear on the problems of today? So I think there is something valuable in it. It's not, you know, I think sometimes journalism history is written off as a little subfield that doesn't really matter, but obviously it does matter in ways that a lot of people don't always think about.
Thanks for tuning in. An additional thanks to our sponsor, the University of Tulsa, and to Taylor & Francis, the publisher of our academic journal, Journalism History. Until next time, I'm your host, Terry Finneman, signing off with the words of Edward R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.